was, in fact, it was a test to see who reads instructions. And in the entire class, only two people passed said test because Jim put the sign-in sheets in the opposite order, and it said across the top for Ohio psychologists only. And everybody signed except for Chris, who...
Tanji.
And Tanji were the only ones who signed the appropriate sheet. They had to actually notice and flip the page. So what we are going to do is we are going to pass around. There will only be one sheet. So you can't screw up unless you sign under somebody else's name. And if you do that, I cannot help you. So I'm going to send this around again. I am also going to call out roll, and because I confess I don't remember everybody's name, and so that it's not obvious, I'm going to call out everybody's name so that, and then I'll be able to tell who left, see, by process of elimination. See?
So
thinking. Okay, John.
Yes.
John. Zainab?
Yes.
Okay. Rick?
Yep.
Tanji, we have to see. Nazreen? Yes. Melinda?
No.
Okay. Samuel?
Here.
Carmen?
Here.
Blythe? Ha ha ha! Blythe. A.M. only. And Hajiba? Okay. And we know, if we'll see about Tanji, does anybody know if she was leaving?
Don't know.
Okay, so she's going to be here. Okay. So, thank you for that, and everybody please sign, because honestly, we can't. And for Blythe, okay, this is going to be a challenge. So, for Blythe, I am going to need to remember to get her to sign this sheet, because she was here for the morning, and I can't really transpose, so whatever. So, if anybody happens to remember that, feel free to remind me, but I... we'll write myself a note. Blythe needs to sign. So you are seeing now accommodations for those of us who have some memory loss. Write everything down. Don't laugh. You're going to get old someday too.
Oh, yeah. Now, what's going to get in the way of you completing that assignment?
Okay. Excellent. Very good question.
That's right. Yeah.
It, however, does not make up for the fact that you flunked Jim's leader test. Which, of course, I'm joking. The real flunk was Jim putting the wrong sign-in sheet up first. Do you think Jim will hear about this? But it doesn't make up for that, but it is a good start. And what will get in the way, I'll tell you right now, what will get in the way is I'll forget all about it. Then, but that's why I wrote it down. Of course, by writing it down, I have to put the note about it someplace where I will find it. Right?
That's true.
Which could be in the course box. See, we've already solved these problems. And plus, I have all you good people who are going to say, did you remember? Yes. Tanji already signed it because she read the instructions.
And Chris.
Not me.
Of course, I also appreciate both Chris and Tanji that you noticed that you had to sign the undersheet and you didn't tell your colleagues about it. I approve.
Yeah, what's up with that?
All right. I mean, it's not their job to tell you to read the directions. And actually, Tanji, Chris started, he had half, but he didn't fully sign because he has Chris Nelso, but he didn't have the end.
That was pretty
and then
close.
He did the second page. Okay, but Tanji didn't sign the first page at all, so she wins.
That's okay. Right.
Good job.
All right, aside from that very important beginning of the class, does anybody have any administrative questions? Anything?
Yeah.
Yes.
For the final exam, are we going to be tested and the whole materials we took from
yes for the whole year, except The class will, the exam I'm going to, will distribute, if you pay for certification, I'll distribute the exam after the June class. So it covers the first three terms. It will not cover the special topics term because that's always different. It'll cover the whole year. So you want to take your time and wait till you feel confident about the whole year. By the way, did everybody get the email about voting for special topics?
I don't think I got it, but I'm going to go check my...
Okay, and if you didn't, shoot me an email to let me know, and I'll send it to you again. And it says, I tried to make it pretty clear because I know if I just say clinical practice or cognitive therapy, you'll just delete it because it's another stupid email from Bart. So I put vote by whatever the date is for special topics in the subject line. So hopefully, anybody out there who did not get that, please let me know and get your votes in before whatever time the deadline is, because we will be determining what we cover in July. So, and did Jim pick some people to do consultation for next time?
No.
No? That's two. Two?
But we always have people that can do it. So.
Yeah. Does anybody want to volunteer? So this is a good class. Sometimes we have classes where everybody just looks blankly, but there's always people who volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody who has anything pressing that wants to get on the docket for next time?
I can do it.
Okay.
I can always do it.
Okay. So we got a couple people, and we'll see who's the most pressing. So no more administrative stuff? Okay, so I'm going to start by talking about dependent personality disorder. Now, after working with borderlines and histrionic patients, people with dependent personality disorder can seem like a welcome relief. Now, there are few people, but very few, there are few who are obviously going to be difficult from the start. These are the people who call for an initial appointment and then call back every 5 minutes and take up all the secretary's time, and because they just have to speak to me before I get out of my session. You know, they keep calling, is she out yet, is she out yet, is she out yet, you know, and they feel the need to be responded to immediately. But that's not typical. Usually, a person with dependent personality disorder seems deceptively simple at first. They're easy to engage in therapy, and they're so cooperative. I have to tell you, this is one of my pet peeves. Whenever a case, especially if I get a referral, and the referral source says, oh, this is going to be a piece of cake, my radar goes up. It's like, don't tell me it's going to be simple, because I don't necessarily buy it, right? So these people seem like they're going to be easy. They're eager to please, and they actually feed our... Now, you know, we go into this business for a reason, you know? I mean, I think most therapists like to feel like they're very helpful, and so they kind of give you the message of, you know, oh, doc, I know you can help me. You're so powerful. I've heard such wonderful things. I know you can help me. And we're kind of like, well, yes, you know, of course. So you get the feeling, you start off thinking it's going to be really easy and straightforward. But I find it just adds to my frustration when the treatment bogs down and the patient stays really passive, and they're very polite and very attentive, but, and you know, I just can't quite understand why you haven't helped me yet, and why, you know, they're very clingy and you know, give, it's like waiting for you to fix everything. Okay, and then I personally have worked with, because I've been doing this for 300 years, I tend to get pretty early on, get physical physical, visceral reactions to different kinds of patients. And I strongly recommend that all of you pay attention to which kind of patients you feel very comfortable with and you're good with, and which not so much. So the very dependent person, I feel this need to make some space, get off of my skin. They're just kind of, you know, so enmeshing and so clingy, and I admit, not my favorite kind of patient. You give me, so if I get a referral and the person says, this person's impossible, nobody's been able to help them. I loved, like last month I was talking about Cindy, who is the histrionic personality disorder. I loved that her compulsive therapist said, oh, you know, she'll never be able to do that. She's impossible. Because first of all, the pressure's off. If nobody else in town has been able to help them, you know, and it won't be any shame if I can. But I know anything I do is going to look really good. So it feels really good. But these people can be very, very frustrating. And they absolutely dig their heels in and resist all attempts to help move them towards being a little more independent. So I don't know if you remember Kathy from the first term. She was, Jim played a couple videos. She was the one who was very depressed with a 10-year-old son, and she'd gone from living with her parents to being married, and then her husband left her when she had a new baby. She's the one who came in suicidal, she, without an appointment. And so she was depressed, but what we hadn't talked about at the time was that she also met criteria for dependent personality disorder. And if you look at page 17, these are the criteria. She really started getting depressed when she was on her own, and that's difficult for anybody as a single mother, but she just felt totally, you know, incapable of handling things. And so she had gone to extreme lengths to, she was staying with Rick even though he really offered, her boyfriend offered very little, but he was there, and so she didn't feel alone. Really couldn't handle being alone and was really terrified that he might leave, and really difficulty making even the most straightforward decisions. Now again, be careful in assessment, because there are lots of people who are dependent, but you want to really go through the criteria, because people can have tendencies without meaning the full criteria, and then you wouldn't give them the diagnosis. So she's one example. The other example, she's a good example of treatment. The not so good example is Emily, who came in, surprisingly, really. She came in for a specific phobia. She had a fear of, she had claustrophobia. And this took many, many forms. She was the most claustrophobic person I think I've ever seen. It was particularly problematic because she had trouble being in a car, if even a passenger or driving, because you're closed in. She had trouble traveling because it involves, you know, airplanes or cars. And also, you don't know if, and she tried, believe me, you don't know how big the room's going to be, and are there going to be enough windows, and so there are a lot of unknowns to Emily. So she came in because for a specific phobia, but as treatment progressed, it became clear that she also had dependent personality disorder, and she had, she was so claustrophobic that she couldn't eat a large sandwich, okay? Mm. And she couldn't drink tea, hot tea, because the fumes made her feel closed in. Yeah, so it was pretty, conceptualization. You don't need arrows. You don't need diagrams for dependent personality disorder. It's pretty straightforward. The person sees themselves as inadequate and helpless. Many of the personality disorders do. But they basically feel like they can't cope, so they need to find someone that will handle life for them. And they are willing to give up all responsibility and subordinate their own needs, and just as long as they're taken care of. And keep this in mind. These are not dependent people who are yearning to be more independent. They do not want to be more independent. They are terrified of being independent. They believe that part of the way they get taken care of is by being so needy. The idea of being more autonomous is a horrifying, horrifying thing, okay? Because they are convinced that they will be abandoned if they're not needy. So I think I made, commented last time about how the histrionic needs to be taken care of, so they grab you by the throat and make sure you are paying attention to them and noticing them and interested in them. Where the dependent person lies on the floor and whimpers and like a pathetic puppy and it's hoping that people will take care of them that way. And so they are, they don't come in. They do not come in because they're too dependent. They come in for, depression often, anxiety, or like Emily with a specific phobia or fears. And honestly, some people, some people seem to manage quite dependently. They get the diagnosis only if it's extreme enough that it actually interferes with their life, or if something changes. Being taken care of is not a terrible thing. The problem is they make this deal. It's unspoken, but they make this deal. You take care of me, and I'll do whatever you want. Unfortunately, the disadvantage is they always have to be very careful to please the other person. So there's always a deep down fear that if they aren't completely passive, if they speak up for themselves, they'll be abandoned. So they always have to walk on eggshells, and there's always a fear of being left. And so they're very unassertive and don't express themselves. If they don't already have a relationship, they can come across, I can feel it on my skin when I'm in the presence of these people, especially if they're coming to see me, because if it's in a social situation, I just run. But they can come across as so desperate that it scares people off. They don't have to say anything. They come across as so needy that it may be hard to find a partner that will take care of them. And actually, a lot of these people, especially the men, and there are plenty of these men, the women seem, at least in Western culture, I think in a lot of cultures, women can get away with being passive and help me, and find big, strong guys who are perfectly willing to take that role, and they feel okay about it, although resentment can build because they don't express themselves and don't take care of themselves, and if something happens in the relationship, they're devastated, like Kathy was, right? Because she was counting on him. A lot of the guys I find, and I don't have the statistics on this, but a lot of the dependent personality disorder males I see they're dependent on their parents. They live, and I'm not saying, please, I love millennials. I'm not saying everyone who comes back home and lives in their parents' basement has dependent personality disorder. I don't say that. But a lot of these guys have never left home, and are looking to their parents to take care of them, which has a specific limit, because usually your parents are older than you are, and so the odds are decent that they might die or get infirm before you do, and then you don't have anybody to take care of you. So
I'm kind of curious about the cultural relevancy of this diagnosis, because a lot of the theme you explain, like my cultural background, South Asia, that they encourage women to be like that. Like,
well,
they are shown really nice women.
And you need to consider it only meets criteria if it's in excess of the cultural norms, okay?
Yeah.
It has to be more than the average,
mm-hmm.
and it has to cause significant problems, okay? So, I mean, even if you look at subcultures, you know, I was always surprised that my mother's generation, I grew up in Southern California. Everyone drives. I mean, you don't have, a family of four doesn't have four cars. They often have six. I mean, you know, everyone drives, but there was a whole group of women my mother's age who didn't drive. And in Southern California, that was quite dependent. But it was kind of their little subculture, and they worked it out, and it wasn't excessive for their place and time, and it wasn't causing distress. And believe me, my mother certainly expressed herself. So, you know, you can be dependent in some ways or not others. So the key culturally is to look at, is it in excess of the norm, and is it causing significant distress? And people really can. Some people can live their whole lives and not, you know, I mean, this is true for a number of the personality disorders, that if you happen to find yourself in a situation that works, you don't necessarily need to deal with it. But they can come across as so desperate that it's hard to find a partner, that lasts. And they often don't learn the skills of independent living, problem solving, making decisions, or they might have the skills but not use them, so the dependency is perpetuated. And the biggie is, if the relationship ends, they're devastated and they have absolutely no idea how to go on. And I'll tell you, as a goal, the goal of being more independent, in case my husband dies, I gotta tell you, that is not motivating. Don't even bother. It's gotta be, goals need to be something current. First, you never want to use the word independent with these people as in the beginning with goals, because that's terrifying. But people really don't work towards hypothetical kinds of goals like that. Even though it makes sense to me to be prepared in case something happens, that doesn't work for them. So the dilemma is that they keep perpetuating their sense of inadequacy by being so dependent and not learning to function for themselves. It's kind of like an anxious person who avoids never learns that they can handle the anxiety-provoking situation. So, and they have the underlying assumptions like, I can't survive without the person taking care of me, I fall apart, and honestly, most of my patients get pretty clear early on that I have a mouth. I mean, they accuse me of a lot of things, but nobody really accuses me of being unassertive, okay? So it's funny, because a number of these people are like shocked when they see that I'm married, because they honestly can't imagine how could somebody so assertive and rash be actually married, and it must have been some great fluke. So, you know, I mean, it just doesn't fit in their worldview. Since the idea of competence is terrifying, and they don't come in with that, don't you bring it up. Don't use the words independence, dependence, assertion, period. Let the troops work on whatever they came for, and when the time comes, they may or may not actually begin to see that changing the personality disorder could make a big difference in their lives. But honestly, that is a great way to scare them off, because that is, you know, the idea is, and you can't, honestly, you can't always use yourself as a role model, because by definition, everyone who's working as a therapist has gotten to a certain level of independence and education and is working and practicing, and which makes you a scary person. So, and not necessarily someone they want to be like. So, so the basic strategy is to work towards their goals. Help, and so that they indirectly, they by succeeding at their goals, they begin to build some self-confidence. And so when that they can get to the point where they can work towards being a little more independent. Now, as with all personality disorders, but this one you really do need to pay attention to the patient-therapist relationship, because they will definitely, all personality disorders play out their issues in the therapy session. Okay, it just makes sense. It's a relationship. And they will pull for you to take care of them. And they, you do need, you can't, you, you in order to engage them, you'll need to allow a little bit of dependence in the beginning. But in the back of your mind, you want to be moving them towards the more independence. So it's actually funny, because in the early works on personality disorders, Milan, the big guru of personality disorders, actually suggested that cognitive behavioral approaches, kind of like with histrionics, he said, oh no, incompatible with cognitive therapy, when actually it turns out that cognitive behavioral approaches are really what's best for histrionic personality disorders. Similarly, early on, people suggested that non-directive approaches might be preferable, because for some reason they think that cognitive behavior therapists are like bossy and tell people what to do. I don't know how they get that. And we actually, it can sound that way, but actually we work really hard to be collaborative. Now think about it. You get a really dependent person in the room and you do non-directive therapy, they run like mad. They run, I mean, they're not look, I mean, if all you do is go, mm-hmm, I mean, they're looking, they want you to save them, they want you to fix them. Now, you have to walk that line. You have to maybe give them a little, give them hope, this treatment works, we can achieve your goals. But if all you do is listen or and they're totally non-directive, they get way too anxious. Because then, I mean, it's really obvious that it's on them. So if you take the dependency into account and modify your expectations, then you can kind of gradually move them. For example, very in the, again, I always start with the agenda, because you know I'm obsessed with agenda. In the beginning, if you ask what would you like to talk about, you're going to get whatever you say, doc, and you're going to get that over and over. And then gradually, and then after several visits, that could be on the agenda. Okay, I know you say whatever I say, but we all have things we want to talk about. We all have things on our mind. So how about if part of your homework this week would be to write down one or two things you want to talk about in the session before you come in. And it's not like they'll go home and just necessarily do it, but then you can ask what'll get in the way of your doing that, and help them to kind of formally participate in the treatment. And don't take it as a given, because it's going to be challenging for them. So you don't use the words. And here's a thing very important with personality disorders is to pay attention to your own thoughts and feelings. I find if I'm dreading seeing a patient, I like my patients. I like patients and I love this kind of therapy because people get better, they achieve their goals. So if I'm dreading seeing a patient, I need to really look at my thoughts and feelings. And I might need to talk to a colleague and get some consultation because that's not me. I mean, sure, would I rather lie on the beach than work? Absolutely. But if I'm going to work, I'm not going to dread seeing a particular person. And it's a clue to personality disorder stuff. And it's very, very important to set clear limits with these people. They will pull for rescue. Clinically, these people are more likely to fall in love with their therapist or to push to be friends. I mean, if you're not good on your boundaries, please get, I mean, it's separate from cognitive behavior therapy, but really boundaries are huge in all treatment, but especially with personality disorders. If you're not good at setting limits, and I know people who have, I mean, I have things I can't even believe. I know someone who was very well reputed in her particular town who actually had a patient come live with her. She was taking care of her. I mean, you know, I am really, I'm very clear, I go way, way far in the direction of limits. And, you know, sometimes I have patients who would make very good friends and who I like a lot. Sorry. And none of this, what do my ethical guidelines say about how long? As far as I'm concerned, once a patient, always a patient. Because my patients come back. A lot of them. We're trying. We're getting older. I know you didn't realize that, but we're getting older. So we're both cutting back a little bit or trying to cut back. Jim had like 5 patients, former patients, come back in 1 week. And not for the same issues. That's the thing. People know you're a trusted person. It's not like they crash and burn and the treatment didn't work. They come back 20 years later when their mother's dying or when they're going through a divorce because they know they can trust their therapist. If I change that relationship and become a friend or, God forbid, act out sexual, I mean, I've just killed any chance of anything besides threatening my license, which I'm not willing to do. But boundaries, very, very important, and these people really have. Honestly, if it's funny, with a dependent person is more likely, and I see this all the time, to fall in love with their therapist. The histrionic person might complain that their therapist fell in love with them, because you know you can kind of see the difference. So you have to be very, very careful. No, even if you do body work, these are not people to do any kind of touching. Be very careful if you're doing exposures that there's no question about that you're going out together. And, you know, you want to be so, so clear because, and watch for rescue. I forget if I've already, maybe, well, stop me if I'm giving this example, but when I supervise therapists, and I supervise sometimes at university hospitals, so I might end up supervising psychiatric residents. I'm a psychologist. I don't prescribe medications. So when I'm supervising a psychiatrist, I make it clear from the beginning, medicine is part of the overall collaborative treatment plan. So I'm the supervisor. Supervisee, do not prescribe medicines unless it's been discussed as part of the overall treatment package and it's integrated into the cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay, so that's a hard and fast rule. So when I get a resident comes in and they say, Dr. Fleming, don't be annoyed, but I'm sure you'll understand. Mrs. Jones came in and she was in such distress that I had to make an exception. I had to give her some whatever, benzo, SSRI, whatever. I had to help her, right? You know, I had to give her medicines and break the rules because she just was so needy. She needed it so much. My antenna are up. Odds are excellent that that person has dependent personality disorder. What tells you the difference, by the way? When you find yourself tempted, I hope it's just tempted and you're not really doing it, but when you find yourself tempted to break one of your own rules, if you're really pissed about it, if you're really aggravated, why did I do that? Oh, I'm such an idiot. Odds are not bad that the patient is actually borderline. Okay, people with borderline personality disorders will suck you in to doing things, but you'll be mad about it. Okay, you'll be annoyed with yourself. You'll feel burdened and angry. Okay? With a dependent person, you feel good about it. You're saving this person. You're helping this person. That's a dead giveaway. So be careful. Always, I mean, rules are there for a reason. And I have to say, the older I get and the more experience I get, the more, yes, rigid I get about my rules. And I'm rigid because they're good rules, and I made them for a reason. There are lots of things you can be flexible about, but be careful and ask yourself, why am I treating this person differently than the last person? Is it because they're coming across as pathetic? They need me. I'm sorry. Life, you know, people come in distressed. They can wait until your next therapy. I mean, if they can't wait, then maybe they need to be in the hospital. But, you know, you don't just throw meds at a patient without considering the overall treatment plan. And you don't make exceptions willy-nilly because they may well be pulling something that reflects their personality and you're buying into it. So be very careful. We don't rescue people. We help them, hopefully. We might coach them. But the real work of therapy is on them. It really needs to be that way. So watch those relationships. Now on page 17, we've got the Overholzer has done a lot of research with dependent personality disorder. And he has kind of a four-stage program. It's pretty flexible, but he sees the stages of treatment. And in the beginning, you do need pretty active guidance. They're going to look to you, and it fits beautifully with cognitive behavioral therapy because we have an active approach. We don't have to be dependent. We have specific things the person can do, setting goals can be difficult because they might say, well, what do you think I should do? Or let me go ask my husband. It's like, well, and we work through that. So in the beginning, you are going to be a little more active and work towards probably towards some behavioral changes. And small steps, and that's okay. It's okay in the beginning, but don't take over. You know, keep asking. Always ask. What would you like to talk about today? Or what do you think would be useful to talk about today? Always ask, after the first session or two, well, what might be a good homework assignment? And always ask, how'd you feel about this session? And you'll go, oh, you're just fabulous. It's so wonderful. I can't even believe. And it's kind of like, okay. And don't let your ego, just don't buy it. We're not that wonderful, but we really are. All right. So.
Are they expressive? I mean, am I going to have difficulty getting this out of them?
Getting rich out of them.
My goals. And are they expressive about why you're here? Why are you?
They're it's interesting. They're cooperative, and so they'll talk, but they'll defer.
You have to talk first, though.
They'll defer to you.
Yeah.
They'll say, you're the expert. You know, whatever you say, I will do. You tell me. You're so good at this. I have heard, I've heard such wonderful things about you. I couldn't dream to, you know. So that it's not like they'll be, if they simply won't talk, that's often really, you know, that might be more passive aggressive. That might be all kinds of things. These people will talk, but they will defer. They're very bad, poor at decision making. And what are setting goals? What's setting an agenda? It's making a decision. It's making a choice. So that is challenging. But they'll talk, but they'll turn it back around to how wonderful you are.
Yeah.
I have a general question about the personality disorder. Is that something by born, or is that something the personality disorder thing, people kind of grow as a circumstances?
Well, you can't. You don't, if you look at the criteria, it has to be a long-standing pattern. No. So you can't diagnose early on. Because
I know,
it can't be.
And
I think that, you know, like every other disorder, there are some genetic tendencies, but a lot of it is learned. And you learn what works for you. And if you grow up in a culture or a family that, and it can be very crossing cultures, can obviously cause a lot of difficulty. So if you grow up in a culture where it you're supposed to be passive and dependent, and then you move into a culture where they expect something different, it could be a very problematic because you don't have you balance. So there's often a mix, because there's always a genetic component of some kind. But never, it's not like people directly inherit a disorder. You can, just like with heart disease, you can inherit a tendency, but if you, watch your salt and exercise and eat vegetables, you don't have to have a heart attack. So, it's going to be a mix. But sure, people learn what works in their families of origin. And often these personality disorders are when they take it to an extreme and don't move past that or balance what really is working for them as adults. So you don't want to just, behavioral stuff is good. You don't want to just do verbal stuff because, again, they'll tell you whatever, what you want to hear, And then you want to turn things around to get them a little more active. You want to still use guided discovery. Be careful. I see this in our tapes, and honestly, I find myself doing it. We have a good guess about what their thoughts and feelings are. We have good guesses about what's really going on. So we get, and if we ask the person, so what was running through your mind? And they pause and take a minute, we often just say, were you thinking this or this? Often. But they're not good. These people especially, if you say to them, well, were you thinking a meteor might fall on me? They'll go, yeah, you're so smart. You got that. We're authority figures, so people will agree with us. And that's not necessarily what's most useful for them. So use guided discovery and shut up. Wait until they respond and then try quoting what they say rather than telling them and interpreting and whatever. So, I had one patient. We were working on pinpointing thoughts and feelings, and so she'd walk into the session and she'd say, well, I felt depressed and really discouraged last week. Why was that? I'm like, I wasn't there. She expected that I could just tell her what that was and she could fix it. Literally, you need to then, nicely turn it around. Well, what was going on? And, that guided discovery is huge. And none of us do enough of it. We often guess and interpret. And really, if we just ask, like, so what was going on? What was running through your mind? What were you feeling? And wait for them to tell us. The most, early on, the most common automatic thought is, I can't. Okay? These people are pretty upfront about their incompetence. That's what's worked for them. So if you ask them to set an agenda, if you give them a homework, I mean, be ready for that. Even if they don't say it, if you ask them to do a thought sheet, for example, they might agree, but then they get home and they're like, I can't do this. So you want to try, if you realize they're dependent, you want to have them, you know, help them to walk through an example in the session. And when you're asking what's likely to get in the way, you know, if they all volunteered, say, you know, are you going to think you can't do it? You know, do you feel like you know, you understand it enough to be able to do it? Let's do one. Let's try it. Because their first thought in life often is, I can't do that. You can get it if you do a mental, little mini mental status exam, which we always do, you know, and say, you know, so could you count backwards from 100 by 7? Oh, the look of panic on people's faces. I can't do that. Now, honestly, I'm not very good at that. I don't like it. It makes me have to think. But these people are like, no, well, I can't. It's not that I don't want to. I can't. And so they don't try. And like if you just present them like you might normally with a thought sheet, you know, it's like, I can't record my thoughts. I mean, that might help some people. And honestly, I have seen patients where, again, I get referrals. People send, you know, we're kind of a, people send us their clients that they have had trouble with, right? That they're stuck on. And I've had a number of times when people have referred clients and said, now, to be honest, this person is not very bright, or this person is actually pretty, you know, limited. And I'm not talking about people who've been diagnosed as mentally retarded. I mean, they actually can convince you that they're stupid. They come across as so needy that you buy into it. And be careful. You take it step by step. Make sure they do some, and you know, discuss their ideas when they say, I can't. Well, let's think about, you know, how can we make it possible for you to do. I had one patient, I mean, she'd been through college, and she's like, well, I can't understand anything written down. It's like, really? I understand there are people who are illiterate. We can work with them. We can use other means. But someone, I mean, it's not that she couldn't, it's just she didn't take the time, and she felt incompetent. So you have to, let's test that out. Let's try something straightforward. And maybe begin to develop the response of, it's challenging for me, but if I stick with it, maybe I can do it. I'm willing to try. Because if you don't get past it, I can't. The problem is, if they go home and then think, I can't do this, then they feel so needy, they don't want to disappoint you, they might just not come back because they can't face telling you that they didn't do the homework. So you kind of need to get that's something that's likely to occur so that you can address it before they're feel like a failure. So in stage one, you're doing a little more active and maybe doing a little more behavioral stuff. Then if the person is able to achieve some of their goals, that might be all they want to do. And you know what? I always like to give people the option of working on deeper issues, but it's not my decision. You know, so if someone comes in, we do a little bit of, like with Emily, you know, we worked very behaviorally on her claustrophobia, and she actually was able to make some real headway with that. It also helped that she didn't actually have much choice because her husband got very ill and couldn't drive. And there was no Uber back in the day. I mean, I'm that old. So she was able to make some initial change. And it's only if the person actually then gets to the point where they've achieved some of the goals and some of their dependency has become, as it does, has become really obvious, then you can give them the choice of signing on to work on some other goals, like, you know, building self-confidence, and you want to find out what they mean by that, or self-esteem, and what specifically do they mean by that. Then if they choose, they can move on to working on, you know, how they feel about themselves, or, you know, their feelings of inadequacy, and, you know, and become a little. You're still not using the words independent unless they start bringing it up and you've built their trust. Also, you know, they have this strong belief that if they got more competent, they'd be abandoned. Okay? Now, with all the personality disorders, don't assume that people live in reasonable environments. They might be right. Who marries one of these really pathetic people? Okay? Or who encourages their kids to stay live in their basement when they're 57? Sometimes the people in their relationships really pull that and want that, and if they did get a little more competent, they might. We don't know. It's not like we're gods. We can't say, oh, it'll be fine. Which is why, if you recall with Kathy, they started talking about assertiveness and they were doing baby steps. If you do a little bit of an experiment and you know, and see how the other person reacts. I also don't assume that the person is staying with them because they're dependent. I don't necessarily know. So you try a little bit and see, does it seem to, you know, what kind of a reaction does it get? And then, you know, help the person. Believe me, your patients might make different choices than you do. I mean, I have patients who are in pretty lousy relationships. If they want to stay there, you know, it depends. If the person's being abused, I'm going to do what I can to help them be safe. But a lot of people choose to stay in relationships that I would not choose to. And if we can help them meet their goals and just, you know, and reduce their distress, and they choose to stay, who am I? And hopefully they'll be one of those people who come back in a few years to do some more work because they realize they could do better. But we don't, you know, you're going to need to explore their relationships and hopefully look at, okay, you know, if, you know, try baby steps, but if they decide whatever they need to do, they need to come to, you know, at least look at the fact that I have a choice. And if I don't have to always be pathetic. So they do have, these people are not dichotomous thinkers in general, but they do have a dichotomous view of independence. And so on page 18, you know, they have, and they really do. I mean, they it's like, if you're dependent, you do everything on your own, and you always do what you're told and agree with everything, and you're helpless. But the independent person is always alone, does whatever she damn well pleases, and handles everything, and is outspoken, aggressive, brash. I mean, they really do think if you speak up at all, you're being aggressive. So if they're ready to talk about that, they're going to need a lot of help with, can you express yourself without being aggressive? One example I like, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because we don't have the time, but this idea of a criteria continuum, Really, I don't think people use continua enough, but they're really handy because it really shakes up people's thinking. And so, if they're dichotomous about something like independence, you can actually take each criteria and do separate continua for each. So, in other words, you start to realize that, well, wait a second, somebody could always be with another person, so does nothing alone, but make some of their own decision. I mean, each criteria could follow along people could follow along a different point of the continuum. So it's not necessarily an either or. And if you can break things down like this, this is the kind of assignment that can go over the course of several sessions, and it's often one that they keep working on and really gets them to start looking at their thinking. Yeah.
What kind of homework will go along with this?
We just normally just started in the session. And then we have them take it home and add criteria on both the totally dependent side and the totally independent side. And you want it as extreme as possible. Mm-hmm. Or so you can have them add to it as they go through their week. You can also have them rate and really think about a wide variety of people they know. Okay? Where does your mother fall? Where is your best friend, your husband? You know? Where do you think I fall if you feel comfortable with that? You know, I mean, so there are a lot of things that they can do with this in between. And also when they find themselves worrying about one of these criteria, then it lends itself to doing a fact sheet about that. And do I have to, you know, what would happen if I did this alone? And what are my fears? So there's a lot of ways you can use this for homework, and a lot of the work does go on in for homework. So
you're not, because weren't you saying earlier you try to avoid saying, using certain terms like dependence and...
But this is later in the treatment.
Oh, later. Okay.
Okay, so this is in at least stage 2, if not stage 3, where they're beginning to actually acknowledge. And stage 3 is if the person acknowledges, you know what, I would like to be a little more independent and autonomous. Absolutely, this is for later. Not in stage 1. And maybe not even in stage 2. But if it's something that's important to them, it will begin to come up, and they'll begin to say, you know, it would be useful if I could go someplace by myself, or it would be useful if I could make at least some small decisions. So early in the treatment, the problem is their thought, I can't. Later in the treatment, you can scare the patients by moving too quickly, and you want to... And then when they drag, if later in the treatment they are dragging their feet, then it's time to really look at the advantages and disadvantages of changing. And it's no joke. If a patient has had this same kind of personality strategy for many years and they change, it does make a difference in their life. And it can affect other people around them. So when I say let's look at the advantages and disadvantages, I don't buy when they say, oh no, it would be just wonderful. You know, if I were less depressed, it would be heaven. I always want to look at the downside because every change has a downside. And if they happen to, I mean, you know, if they're a little more independent, it will affect their relationships. So it's, you know, be open to looking seriously at the downside. Now, I'll give you a quick example of Dorothy was a 24-year-old housewife. She was one of the most dependent people I've ever seen. She very dependent on her mother, never learned to do things on her own. She eventually got married. She married her high school sweetheart and literally moved next door to her mother. And she would do things like she would call her mother to ask what she should have for breakfast, what she should wear. I mean, we are talking no decisions. And then her husband got a job in Ohio. Now, there's a whole group of people, many of whom meet criteria for dependent personality disorders. I don't know if other towns have this, and or if it's unique to Cleveland, but they're a whole group, and if yes, it's often women, it would not need to be, but it's, I call them women who are being held in Cleveland against their will. So they're not kidnapped. Basically, I think there are a lot of people who, and the reason I think it's women, because these people are very dependent. So anyway, husband gets a job offer in Cleveland. Wife has this, you know, feels like she can't say anything. She can't argue with it. So passively goes along. And is
miserable,
and really, it's interesting because if someone's determined to be miserable in a certain location, believe me, they can. And so Dorothy was a great example of that. And her husband, I mean, this was huge to her. Her husband got a job, and she lived, I think, in Connecticut. You know, her mother was in Connecticut, and husband got a job in Cleveland, and she was just overwhelmed and very, very depressed. And as treatment progressed, she wasn't moving at all. You know, she was not, you know, she wasn't following through on anything. And so we started looking at, well, what would happen, you know, what are the pros and cons of actually getting less depressed? And she was pretty clear. If she was convinced that if she was depressed enough, if she adapted to Cleveland and felt good, then she'd be stuck here forever. And if she stayed depressed, maybe there was hope that her husband, you know, that they could move back to Connecticut. And she really made, you know, I mean, she didn't say this in session one, but as she dragged her feet and we looked at, okay, what would happen if you were less depressed? What would be the downside? It became pretty clear. And so, guess what happened to make her less depressed?
Job offer.
Her husband gave up and moved back to Connecticut. I don't think he had a job now offer. I mean, she won, and that's how she got less depressed. And I talked to her about, well, while you're here, and actually a lot of the women in the category of, you know, a lot of women who are not as extreme as Dorothy and are willing to work to adapt to living in Cleveland and actually find that there's some advantages to being here if they were a little less dependent on whoever was way back where they were. But she was clear. She really didn't, you know, it wasn't in her interest, in her view, to get less depressed. And so she didn't. And you know what? That's her choice. I don't feel bad about it. That was her choice. And at least I wasn't beating my head against the wall. We realized, you know, her real goal was to get back to Connecticut. That was her goal. It wasn't to be less depressed. So you do have to be careful about the motivation. And when the person really then, if they move to stage three, where they're actually becoming more autonomous, then you need to look at, do they actually have skill deficits that are getting in the way? Not everybody does. Some people have the skills, but they're not using them because they don't want to seem like Kathy. Kathy was actually quite skilled. She's much more skilled than her boyfriend, Rick. But she didn't, you know, she wasn't processing that she could handle life. But sometimes they do have skill deficits and need to learn things like problem solving, how to do basic kinds of decision making. Now, decision making for a dependent person is anxiety provoking. So one strategy I like that I'll just throw out there is because the idea is scary to make your own decisions, so you can do a hierarchy of decision making. And you can start with very small decisions, like choosing what to eat for breakfast or choosing what to wear. And often, unless it's Dorothy, often people will find, well, I do make, because most people end up making a lot of decisions on a daily basis. They don't just, they don't see them as important decisions. So if you have a hierarchy and gradually build up the confidence to make decisions, that can be an excellent strategy. And then the last phase is relapse prevention, which is always very important to look at. Okay, how can you maintain these goals and continue moving forward? The thing about with dependency, back in the day, so if you're doing a regular treatment, if you're doing a weekly treatment and then end, these people, that's terrifying to these people, and because they have gotten a little bit, you know, even if you try to move them, they are still have a tendency to be dependent. And what I've heard back in the day, I heard from many people with other theoretical orientations, that it's when they approach termination that these patients would have a huge crisis and move backwards. And it was their way of say, of not having to end treatment. And so the structure of cognitive therapy is really helpful with that, because I try to avoid, sometimes it's unavoidable, but I almost never see person weekly and then end. And you certainly do not need to do that unless you have something come up that's a big surprise. These are people who do much better if, as you go through stage one, you know, you meet regularly, and then you can space out the visits, and they can build the confidence that they can do it with a little less time. And so by the time they're ready to terminate, it's not a drastic scary thing. They've become a little less dependent, but also they've seen, if someone can go a month without seeing me and they actually keep moving forward, that's a real clear demonstration that they are going to be able to do this. And remember, I always, if possible, offer booster sessions. So just to wrap up with the case example, so Kathy did actually very well. She was able to learn that she could be a little more assertive, especially, you know, and she, after the suicidal incident, she actually got her dream job. I mean, she got a job that she really loved. She was more assertive with Rick and discovered that you could hit him on the head with a brick and he wasn't going to leave because he had such a good deal. So she actually was... moved on, you know, for who was less concerned about that and was able to be more, you know, more independent, much less depressed, and was able to terminate treatment. Emily, with the claustrophobic, was a different matter, and she was a major mistake of mine. That was very long ago. I was a child. But I have never done it. I had never really done it before or since, but she had legitimate, and I think this was legitimate, but I may be partly excusing my own, the fact that I got sucked in. She had both her husband and her adult son had a slew of medical problems. I mean, just overwhelming. And so we worked through some of the basic claustrophobia, and she was able to function on a better basis. But she was so taken up with all the medical stuff and the visits and all that she needed to do, she convinced me to keep seeing her without specific goals. Big mistake. With a dependent person, I mean, what was I thinking? Seriously. Normally, you know, because she had no one, her husband was a medical mess, her son, who ended up, he was such a medical mess, he ended up actually killing himself. And talk about traumatic to have your child kill himself. I mean, you know, the situation was genuinely bad. She didn't have time. Normally I would say, you know, she needed support, okay? I like to think of myself as supportive, but that's not the therapy. I don't do supportive therapy, period. You know, I just don't. I work towards goals. I try to be supportive as we're working, accomplishing something. I had no idea how much I would hate being supportive and not going anywhere. And so it was not, I got stuck in this treatment that was basically endless without going anywhere. And yes, it would have been, you know, we could have done goals such as to develop other relationships where that you can get support from besides me, but she didn't have time because she's at the hospital. I mean, you know, I got sucked in. So guess what had to happen? How bad it got? Guess what had to happen for the treatment to end and for me to be saved from this?
Yeah, to terminate.
No, because I had got myself, couldn't see a way to terminate. So, what do you think had to happen?
You move out of state.
Huh?
Just kidding, you moved out of state.
Tempting. But basically, the treatment did not end until she died. And I did not kill her. Okay, I did not. But seriously, I felt trapped because she was so needy. I mean, it was not good. She was so needy and got me so convinced. And then I made this agreement to see her. And I said, well, now maybe we could, you know, start working towards that. And that she, you know, she'd already known that I would see her even if she didn't work on the, I mean, really, it was bad. And I could have been, it felt then at that point, it felt like abandonment, you know. So, believe me, that was a while ago. I've never done it since. Yeah.
But I can't help but thinking that maybe she needed a therapist to process all the things that she's going through, not necessarily a friend support, because a friend cannot provide that.
That's fine. Next time I get one of those, I will send them to you. But that is not basically what my business partner says, and he thinks this about a lot of my patients.
Okay.
Basically, she was whining and venting. And, I mean, I understand that people need support, but I also think, I mean, A, that's not the kind of therapy I do well. Believe me, it's not. And if that, I don't believe that anyone really needs only that. And I think a trusted person, but not forever, with no purpose. I don't even feel for me that it's ethical to take patients' money or insurance companies' money when it becomes clear this is not at, and with a dependent personality, it was fostering her dependency, and that was not a good thing. Yes.
Is that like she was more, that's like she was abusing the situation? She was more abusive towards you. Is that how, because it's just like to feed on her need and on her.
You know, I mean, I put the entire responsibility on me. I wasn't being abused. I didn't like it, but I got myself into it. And if I had been more, I tried. I got consultation. I couldn't think of a legitimate way out. And luckily, she was quite a bit older than I am, so it didn't last forever. And by the way, her son, that was very unfortunate. You know, I mean, obviously, anybody needs help in going through that kind of grief. But her husband, with all the medical problems and whatever, he outlived her. And that guy often, you know, the caregiver often, I mean, does go first. And so with all the stuff, she passed away first. And I've never done that since. So I do not, I mean, really be careful. Because, yes, people need support, but they also need to make their lives work for them. And if you're it, you can't. I don't think that's a healthy role, especially with this kind of person. But I'll keep that in mind, and I'll keep you in mind for your referrals in the future.
I'll give you my card.